This Week in Radio Tech is supported by Violet Microphones at violetusa.com and by the Broadcaster's Desktop Resource at thebdr.net.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twirt.
Flashlights? Check. Webcams? Check. And Chris Tarr talks about building a station from the ground up.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up, Dad?
Yeah, all your days are belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
This week's special guest, Mike Messick, along with Chris Tarr, Chris Tobin, and Tom Ray.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
Hi, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host, and we're glad you're here. This is the show where we talk about engineering of radio stations, engineering of audio and streaming audio, and doing remote broadcasts, and taking care of broadcast transmitters, and all the other things that go with a broadcast radio station, whatever form that may take. It's been very traditional for years, and now here in this new modern era of the internet and lots of technology, it's changing just a bit. So if that's what you want to hear about, you're tuned to the right show, and we welcome you in very, very much. Along with us today, let's introduce our galley of co-hosts from New York City, Tom Ray. Hi, Tom.
Greetings, Kirk. Hey, Happy New Year.
Thank you. You're speaking to us from, what, your ham shack?
My ham shack in New Windsor, New York. I sent you my picture today.
I know.
You,
it's so cool. I'm going to put that on the website.
No. Cool.
That's a very. I notice you're also very close to the power panel.
Actually, that's the top unit's an antenna tuner. The bottom unit is the linear amplifier.
Oh,
which is good.
Oh. No, I mean,
800
watts, up on
and it
the
has
wall.
Tubes.
Looked like you had a breaker panel up on the wall.
Oh, yes, I have it there in case I trip something off. I've been known to hop up on 20 meters and trip off the GFCIs by accident.
Okay, all right.
One of these days I'll get around to replacing them and I won't have that problem.
As usual, we got to do our usual disclaimers. I should say that I'm an employee. My bread is buttered by the folks at Telos, Omnia, and Axia, and I'm the international director of, business development. So I try to get people to put our technology to use. And Tom, you work for the folks at Buckley.
Yes, I'm Vice President of Engineering of Buckley Broadcasting and work out of WOR Radio, New York City.
Nice place, too. I plan to visit you again probably in a couple of months.
Excellent. Excellent. Let me know when. I'll make sure I'm out of town. No, I mean...
Also with us from Manhattan, it's Chris Tobin. Hi, Chris.
Good evening. Hello.
We're glad you're here. You're speaking to us from your palatial condo, yeah?
Yes, overlooking the Manhattan skyline. It's very nice tonight.
So, you know, someday you and I have got to meet, not just for dinner, but maybe we could have dinner at your place.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
I like the way he invited himself over.
I'll bring the appetite.
Well,
you bring the spaghetti.
Oh, not a problem. We could definitely find some nice Italian food for you.
Well, Chris, you've regaled us with a number of stories about engineering for radio in New York City, and I think this is fascinating. So thanks for being a co-host, and this show will be no different. Chris, who's the folks that bred your butter?
I'm employed by the folks known as CBS Broadcast and CBS Radio Division here in New York City. We have six radio stations that I am party to. We have two news stations, one sports, and the other three are music FM stations. And recently, looking at the Arbitron PPMs, it appears that our FMs are doing very well, and our AMs are right on the top as well. So we've got stations in the top 10 in the market.
That PPM is certainly interesting technology. Now, Chris, you're probably one of the few engineers who gets to the transmitter site via subway.
That's correct. Yes, I am happy to say that I have three transmitter sites that find themselves atop of the Gorilla Building, as some may know it, or the Empire State Building.
That is such a great building. Oh, man.
That is, it's part of the skyline. When people ask, where do you work? I sometimes say, well, you see that large spire that sits on the skyline? Yeah, I have one place there. I have three offices right there in that building.
You know, something that we will do that will be so fun for us and for our listeners, I should say our viewers, because I promise you, in a few weeks, we're going to be on video on the Twit Network, the network that Leo Laporte started. And I've been in constant negotiations and talks with Leo and his right-hand man that kind of runs things there, Dane Golden, and also Colleen Kelly, who was the IT person there. Colleen has been on our show before, and she'll be back. They're going to give us a slot to have a show that is actually streamed live on video. I don't know if they're going to archive the shows or not for later playback or playback on demand, but at least we'll have the show on video. Now, when we do that, we'll be able to show pictures of some of the things that we're talking about. And Chris Tobin, I want you on a future show when we're on video to give us a tour of the Empire State Building and the transmitters, as long as you don't show us any secrets that, you know, that CBS doesn't want shown.
Sure. That would be easy. That would be fun.
That would be so cool. I've been to a few transmitter rooms up there myself at the Z100 room, and gosh, I was at the what's the top rated Hispanic station?
WSKQ.
SKQ. Yes, I think I've been to their transmitter site.
Yes, they have a very relatively new, within the last 2 years, a transmitter facility. It's very nice.
Okay.
Well done. It even has a place for you to sit, and there's a bathroom, and you can actually pull out a cot, and there's a kitchenette.
Wow. Wow.
So if they have new overnights there, it's self-contained. It's really nice.
Well, also joining us is Chris Tarr, one of our abnormal co-hosts. Hi, Chris.
Hi there.
Chris, you are speaking to us not from your usual palatial mansion in Wisconsin, but a different place.
I am in Door County, Wisconsin today.
Is that Bailey's Harbor?
Well, actually, we're in Sturgeon Bay right now, working on a station in Bailey's Harbor.
Okay. All right. So, and you have brought along a guest on this show. Who's that?
I have Mike Messick, who is the owner of WLGE in Bailey's Harbor.
Hey, Mike, are you there?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, you got one mic?
Yeah.
One microphone?
It's a low-budget show here in Door County, Wisconsin.
Mike Messick, we're glad to have you along. Now, Mike, are you the owner of WLGE?
I am the co-owner. My wife and I own the radio station.
Okay. All right. Good. So
started up from the ground up on April 26th, almost 2 years ago.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, I know what that's like. Well, I've started about 12 radio stations. Oh,
they've got to get better. They've got to get easier from after the first one.
Did you put all the equipment on your credit card like we did?
I think three of them. It was spread over three. Yeah. We were trying to maximize our air miles as best we could.
Oh, man. You know, it's funny when I hear people complaining to the FCC about big companies like Clear Channel, and we can't get a radio station because it costs so much, and only the big guys with lots of money can get them. No, you can get a radio station. Get your credit cards out and max them out on some equipment and buy a small-town radio station, and wham, you're there. You got a radio station.
Something like that.
Well, I know where you are. We're going to talk to Mike Messick about small market radio engineering and some of the things that he has had to learn and put up with and with some of the things that Chris Tarr has taught him. Hey, Chris, are you back with us?
I am.
So quick disclaimer on Chris. You work for the guys at Intercom.
I work for the man, yes. Intercom, I am the director of engineering for their Milwaukee and Madison radio stations. And I just got to say, you know, when we go to video, does that mean I have to wear pants when I do this now?
You got to wear a shirt.
I mean,
you got to wear a shirt.
You're killing me.
Depends on how far out that camera is, and I hope you are wearing pants.
Hey, guys, let's jump right into a few topical subjects this week. And, of course, let me get to the right screen here. I wanted to chat about this thing about Ford. Ford is going to offer factory-installed HD radios that have iTunes tagging. Is this significant? Is this a little thing that helps a little bit? Is this just some distraction confusion? Or is this really cool?
I think it's really cool because once you get it to a Ford and a Chevy, now the masses are going to be exposed.
Yeah.
Which is something I've been screaming, hollering, and yelling about for the last 5 years.
Let me describe this just a minute here. Ford plans to offer factory-installed HD radio receivers with iTunes tagging capability in their 2010 models. And the action makes Ford the first auto manufacturer to offer the tagging capability in a factory-installed in-dash radio. So with iTunes tagging, users mark songs for later purchase at the iTunes store. You're driving around the road, you hear something you like, you push a button, and somehow it gets memorized, and then you can buy it from the iTunes store. Is this something that occurs in everyday life? Would you like to be able to do that?
I think so. Eh. I think people like to.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we're so enthusiastic here.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things where I think originally it was a solution to a problem that didn't exist. Yeah, I don't think there's a huge amount of people clamoring to tag songs. And not only that, but the one downside to this is that people are going to have to learn what stations you can use the tagging on and what you can't. And so, I mean, you know, it is, it's going to be good. And I've seen it in action, and it's really kind of neat. It's not one of those things that's going to make me jump out and get a radio.
Maybe we as engineers are the wrong people to ask, because I know that hanging around radio stations when I did full time, you give me any artist or title of a song, and my usual response is, you know, I liked that song the first million times I heard it, and it's a little old on me now. But we're not representative of the typical consuming public who may hear a song. Oh, man, what is that song? Well, here, push this button, and now you've captured whatever it is, and you can buy it later. Now, I was, in fact, this happened just today. I was we were listening to some song on the radio. In fact, I think my wife and I were at Shoney's, and I heard the song on the radio. I said, I kind of like that song. It sounds like a country song. Is that Carrie Underwood? She says, no, it's Taylor Swift. I said, well, I wish I knew what that song was. I've heard it several times, and I really like it. So yeah, maybe I would use something like this from time to time.
Well, I think the key though is that the stations have to enable the technology on their end for it to work. So you'd have to know whether or not the station is running the back end on that for that to work.
Well, sure.
If I have the technology correct.
Surely the radio would give you some kind of indication as to whether it's available.
Yeah, the last time I had looked at that, there was actually a coding that had to be sent down in HD. Along with the song, instead of just the title of ours, there's actually some coding that went on that did all that. Not again, that was the early revision of this, that it wasn't actually based on PAD or RDS data. It was actually a code that was sent down, and when you tagged it, it saved the code and matched the code with the iTunes store.
Ah, okay,
that's correct. That is correct. Yeah. That's still the way.
So the radio station, the radio station that you're listening to has to have that enabled for that function to work.
Chris Tobin, do any of the CBS stations do iTunes tagging?
Yes.
Really?
We all do. Yes.
What equipment or software or implementation is involved with that?
It's through the Ubiquiti folks, the Harris product. It's nothing really special. It's just coding you type in. It's nothing fancy. We actually, our digital media group folks are now working with it, because we're doing the tagging on our, the internet streams as well as our HD streams.
Oh, so I can listen to a CBS music station on an internet stream and do the same kind of tagging.
Yes, that's what I'm told. They're working out all various little details.
Hmm.
The only thing it's a novel concept, and I agree with Chris Tarr that it's sort of like, well, is it really something I'm going to go out and kill myself for? Working with three FM stations that serve a market from the ages of 12 to 55, we have an oldie station, an adult contemporary station, a hot AC, and a top 40, very young skewed station. Of the three, the only ones that we're actually getting feedback from are the top 40 station folks.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I would expect. And they're very active, and they're all about it. But as soon as something goes amiss, if that tagging isn't working right, that HD carrier isn't where it should be, they're out. They're gone. They're no longer interested in dealing with it.
Hmm.
That's the problem I see.
If our listeners want to find out more about this tagging, this is a story that is in Radio World at rwonline.com. And you can just look for the headline, Ford to offer factory-installed HD radios with iTunes tagging. Clear Channel has put made available its iHeart Radio mobile application for the Android phone, the Motorola Droid, the HTC Droid, the HTC MyTouch, and the Samsung Moment. Anybody used iHeart Radio?
Besides, I've used it.
Yeah.
I've used it. It's nice. It functions.
Yeah.
It works. But the idea of having to have a separate application to run something I'm accustomed to just getting off the radio is just annoying.
Oh, yeah.
That's the only drawback. But it works. It should be interesting.
Having grown up a lot of my life in Kentucky, I tell you, one of my favorite radio stations was WLW in Cincinnati. And I really have no chance to listen to it. I'm not driving at night, typically. I often don't think about it. if I'm sitting at my desk. But boy, with that little iHeartRadio, I can tune in WLW on my BlackBerry. And if as long as the edge network that I'm on, I'm on T-Mobile, which is not real fast in Nashville yet, but it normally supports it pretty well. I get a little buffering from time to time. So from that point of view, I kind of like it. I guess I didn't realize until later on after I installed the app that iHeartRadio is a Clear Channel product. And so, therefore,
and that's the thing. That's the only problem I have with it, and not with it in general. But, you know, every group has their own app.
Uh-huh.
You know, we've got Intercom does FlyTunes, Clear Channel does iHeartRadio, CBS has a different one, and, you know, they're all, so, you know, there's really not one application. There is one, I think it's called Wonder Radio, it's a $5 app at the iTunes store that actually does a pretty good job of aggregating everybody's streams and presenting it in one application and kind of bypasses everybody's proprietary players. I think that is kind of cool, and I really would like to see, you know, and it's a dream, I'm sure, of, you know, the radio groups getting together and just, you know, standardizing on one app across all those platforms for all the radio stations. And, you know, I think it's just going to make a better end user experience.
There is an app, at least for the BlackBerry, called Nobex Radio Companion, and it was free. And I haven't used it lately, but I remember, I was listening to WLW, actually, on the Nobex. It seems that they... that Nobex all makes it really easy to hear advertising that was on the radio station, or maybe it's their own radio, their own advertising. I'm not sure.
I use it all the time on my BlackBerry. It's the stream, whatever you're streaming from that radio station.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah, I use it all the time. That's what I like about it. It's ubiquitous. It's agnostic as to far as who's broadcasting the signal and netcasting the signal.
Yeah, yeah. All right.
I do have an issue with each of the companies, broadcast companies, having their own player. And, you know, velvet rope garden type approach. I don't think for the end user it's a smart move.
That is a good analogy, velvet rope garden.
Yeah, phone companies.
Yeah.
The cellular industry.
Yeah.
You know, and I've had arguments with our digital media folks, and they're telling me I have it all wrong because this is the only way you can show monetizing works, and you can track and put together numbers, you know, PowerPoint presentations for those advertisers who don't believe it works. And I always tell people, I say, well, back in the day before Arbitron came around, how did people sell advertising on radio stations? Oh, that's right. It was word of mouth by the end user.
Some good news from a couple weeks ago. Leslie Stimson reports this in Radio World. Olympia Snow, the senator from Maine, would like to see more technical experts at the FCC.
Hallelujah.
Hallelujah. Well,
the Lord. There's a dream that's not going to happen.
Well, and they didn't really define technical experience either.
Oh, really? According to the story by Leslie, the FCC Commissioner's Technical Resource Enhancement Act, introduced by Senator Olympia Snow of Maine in the Senate this week, which was a couple weeks ago, is interesting. Leslie says, as we've reported, the measure would add an additional staff position to each of the five commissioner offices of the Federal Communications Commission. The extra staffer would need to be an electrical engineer or computer scientist. Well, that is a bit broad, isn't it?
Just a little.
Yeah.
How about some experience in the communications industry in that respect?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
How about maybe the commissioners themselves having some technical background like they used to do? I don't know. We have to create a whole new layer just to...
Oh, details. Come on now.
Yes, I know.
Environment,
it's all about building more things.
Well, you know, the thing is, I do think at least it's a first step.
Originally, the original charter for the FCC had that in it, and then it slowly disappeared.
Oh, yeah, I think you're right.
It's interesting how it's come around.
Well, okay, that's some of the news from this week. A couple things we're going to cover in the show, and let's get right to Mike Messick and his experience as a small-town radio owner, because this is interesting to me. This parallels a lot my own experience, because I have an engineering background as well as an on-air background, and I'm part owner of a small group of stations now, and my business partner in these ventures, doesn't have classical engineering training, but he's a lot more available than I am. I've got a full-time job with the folks at Telos, so I don't have much time to go do engineering for these radio stations I'm part owner of. So It sounds like a kind of a similar deal with Mike Messick and Chris Tarr. Mike, apparently you hired Chris to come build your radio stations, help you out and teach you a few things, help teach you how to keep them on the air.
He foolishly kind of volunteered a lot of his time.
Oh, no.
Yeah, my wife and I own the radio station, and you know, that was really key in getting somebody to really help us, give us, you know, advice on equipment and as far as, you know, tower company and what automation system to, you know, to explore. I came from a programming background, and that's what I've done. I've never done sales for the most part, and engineering to me was, you know, turning the board off and on when I would come into the morning. So, you know, it was a real high learning curve in that, you know, having really no previous experience other than putting a car stereo in. So there.
Mike, it sounds like then, you know, some of the listeners to this show are people who are just curious about audio and broadcast engineering. So they may or may not have a lot of experience in broadcast engineering. They may know a little bit about it. They've hooked up home stereos, maybe a little audio console here and there. So, Mike, coming from a programming background, which is fairly non-technical in terms of hooking things up and making them work and you know, getting done the programming you want to get done, what in the last, you know, 2 years with Chris Tarr, what are some of the things that you've learned that you feel are key and important to you being able to be a little bit self-sufficient with your small town station?
Getting to know what I think each piece of equipment really does do in its function, in its you know, its purpose in the whether it's the audio chain or it's the transmission chain or in every aspect. I mean, there's different sides to it, in that one of the things that from the programming side, what was really important to me was to have the best sounding audio that we possibly could do. And, you know, in dealing with Chris, and Chris has different ears than I do, and it was, I think, invaluable for Chris saying, okay, well, this is the processor and this is what this does, and imagine it like a funnel, and, you know, this piece does this and this and this and this. Chris has been an outstanding teacher, and I think that if you're going to go do that, you have to be very, I don't want to say very self-sufficient, but you have to be self-sufficient enough to where you can't always rely, you know, Chris has got a big job handling Milwaukee and Madison all the time. And, you know, I'm very fortunate in the fact that he's sitting in, you know, my office right now at the house. That doesn't happen very often. And if you're planning on doing it on your own, I mean, you need to learn as much as possible and not be afraid to mess things up or, you know, to ask questions and, you know, what does this do? And I think that's really key, is a desire to want to learn that. I mean, I've seen other owners to where they're completely hands off, and they would, you know, they'd much rather call an engineer versus try to learn something on their own. Or, you know, always be in fear that they're going to break something, or, you know, they don't know what this does. I worked for another operator earlier in my career to where there were stickers on pieces of equipment in the studio that said, what did it say? It said, oh, a critical component, which meant to him, stay away. So, you know, but so I've seen it from both sides, and I didn't want to be that guy. I wanted to be the one that, you know, that didn't have the stickers on the equipment and at least wanted to know that I could get by on a daily basis without having to call Chris or some of the other folks that have helped us out too. So
tell me about a few specifics, Mike. What can you do now? What has been important to you to be able to do now that you couldn't do when you first were starting this radio station?
You know, the little bits and pieces, getting the RDS back up on the air after you have to restart the computer, fixing pathing in the building for networking, getting the streaming computer back to where.
Oh, these are all computer things. These aren't transmitter and console per se.
No, you know, we're very fortunate in the transmitter that we did choose has been just rock solid, and, you know, knock on wood, it's been fantastic. But there have been issues to where it was very interesting with our STL, for example. The way it looked on paper, it was flawless and an excellent signal. And we found Door County is very hilly. It's got you know, it's very wooded. And from what something looked like on paper to what the end result was, and having to go another 30 or 40 feet higher at the station side to get a better hit to the tower. So, I mean, there have been a lot of those things, too, and, you know, in learning about how gain, how different antennas work, and, you know, different cable widths and how you lose gain in that versus gain. You know, it's been one thing after another from the engineering point that has really made me more feel comfortable on a daily basis to be a little bit more self-sufficient.
Yep. Yeah. So if something breaks around the station now, you're a lot more comfortable either rebooting it, fixing it, or calling Chris and telling him more about what's wrong than, hey, it doesn't work.
Yeah, he keeps asking me to fix it. You know what? One of the things I got to give him credit for, and I think this is a good moral to the story for anybody who's thinking about doing this, is so often I see, you know, these small market guys who they come to an engineer and go, build this as cheaply as humanly possible.
Yeah.
And, you know, end up buying, you know, used equipment, things that, you know, buying other people's problems. And, you know, Mike came to me and said, well, you know, we don't have a lot of money, but, you know, I'm not an engineer, so I'm not going to pretend to say this is what I need to get. If it were your money and your radio station, what would you do? And we sat down and we came up with it. And for example, you know, I said, you really need to buy a brand new transmitter, you know, because I'm going to be 3 hours away. And, you know, new transmitters now, like a Nautel, which is what we ended up with, you can purchase with a lot of redundancy, you know, dual IPAs and things like that, that will keep you on the air even at low power. You know, you really have to work hard to kill it. And, you know, for example, a lot of the studio equipment was B-stock that he went and researched and, you know, through BSW and other providers and said, you got any returns? You know, I like this. Do you have anything unboxed that I could get? And the end result was a, you know, beautiful facility. And again, you know, not a lot of maintenance headaches, for example, for the transmitter. You know, he could have bought a used tube transmitter that required a lot of maintenance, but instead spent a little extra and, you know, knew that because this thing was going to be in the middle of nowhere, you know, 3 hours away from the guy who put it in, you know, it might be not a bad idea to buy something that is going to be, you know, is going to run well. So,
Chris, you said something there at the beginning of your talk that really impressed me about Mike, and that is, if you were spending your money, what would you buy? And
right.
My goodness, that is the right question to ask an engineer.
Yeah, exactly. And I was floored. It was the first time anybody asked me that. Really? Okay, well, let me tell you, this is what I would do. You know, every place I've ever worked, here's the things that drove me nuts, and here's what you can do to avoid that. And, you know, like I said, the end result for him was, you know, and he talks about, oh, yeah, I learned about computers. He didn't talk about it a couple times he was out at the transmitter site where we actually did have a problem and came through with flying colors, especially with, you know, the Nautel. I can have the manual out and kind of walk him through these things and, you know, say, okay, hit this button, pull the module up, put it in, hit reset, tell me what happens. And, you know, we've gotten through these, you know, the minor issues that we have had. So, you know, even aside from computers, he's learning transmitters and how they work and stuff. But yeah, that one, you know, that one question blew me away. And I think in the end, that's really, I think, you know, has really paid off for him in terms of you know, maintenance and, you know, keeping his sanity. Because again, you know, the original plan was he had budgeted for contract engineering, figuring it would happen on a somewhat regular basis. He hasn't needed it.
Yeah, yeah. Because he's been able to handle some things on his own or with telephone talking through from you.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
Tom and Chris in New York, do you guys have anything similar to this, or is the big city environment a completely different animal than a small town environment?
Oh, it's definitely a completely different animal in the sense that I don't even have the luxury of talking to people that try and give them any common sense. And trust me, no one at our place comes to me and says, how would you spend the money?
Oh, man, yeah.
I go to the we'll say, the derogatory bean counter phrase, since that's a popular term these last 20 years, and I say to them, how do you think we should spend the company's money in order to solve this problem? And it's actually mind-boggling, the answers I get back. That's not my job. I can't speak for the company. But you can't put in that purchase order, or you can't buy what you need. It's like being at a Mexican standoff without any bullets.
Oh, my goodness.
Mm. It's just... So I applaud Mike. And you know what? You've got the right thing, the right attitude. You're going to be successful. You're going to enjoy it. And it's good for you.
Tom, Buckley is a bit more of a closely knit company than a big corporation like CBS Radio. How are things the same or different with at Buckley?
Well, the nice thing about Buckley is... It's nice and it's not nice. I mean, what's nice is that it's owned by a family of four people. So, I mean, we don't have the deep pockets. We don't necessarily have some of the budgets you get at a CBS or a Clear Channel or some other companies. But on the other hand, when you need something, you pick up the phone, you call the guy that matters, you say, I need, he says, why, you say, because, and he says, yes, no, maybe, or go to hell. And it happens. Now, when we built the new facility there, well, gosh, Kirk, it's almost 5 years now that we've been down at 111 Broadway.
The studio's at WOR, right?
Yes.
Okay.
It was basically, he just looked at me and said, Tom, tell me what we need, and let's make it work, and let's make it happen. Here's what my goal is. Let's marry it with your goal, and let's just make it happen, which was great because I felt very lucky. I had the freedom to do what I needed to make the facility work and to make it do what it needed to do. On the other hand, he trusted me that I wasn't going to spend $5 million if I only needed a million and a half, you know, so.
Tom, when we get this show on video, we need to do a walkthrough of WOR as well, some pictures, because to my practical radio engineer mind, WOR's facilities are a superb example of not spending too much and not spending too little. It's just a great balance, and you have the equipment that makes the thing work, and you have enough redundancy. Not everything's not completely redundant, but have enough redundancy that will handle almost any problem.
Oh, you bet, and that was one of the plans, and plus all the studios are designed. There's some minor differences between studios, but as opposed to our old facility at 1440 Broadway, I mean, if the morning show studio went down, they were dead in the water because the other studios didn't have the capabilities they needed.
Yeah.
In these studios, we have the capabilities in all the rooms. We may not have, I think the morning show studio has 8 or 9 computer monitors. We may have 6 or 7 different computer monitors, and we're missing like 2 computers in the other rooms, mm-hmm. but they can go in and do the morning show.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what counts. And yes, we'll do a walkthrough of the WOR facility. We should do a walkthrough of all of our transmitter sites because we do have a new transmitter facility too. And you've got to show the Tom Ray video.
Oh, wait,
the music video.
Oh, yeah, that one. Yes, that'll be fun. We'll do that actually, I edited 2 different videos for you. One was the personal, you know, for your wife and mom to see and be proud of, you know, Tommy Ray. Mm-hmm. And then there's the other one that we show at a lot of Telos Omni and Axia presentations.
Yeah. I'm talking the one with the hat.
That's yes, cool. Yes. Okay. Oh, classic jump cut with Tom throwing a hat onto a hat rack.
It took us like 5 takes, but I actually did it. I couldn't believe it. Oh, man.
I want to get back to Mike Messick now, and because small town radio is where I spent all my time. My goodness, I was never in my career, I wasn't a good enough engineer, I felt, to go be in, you know, Dallas or even a Milwaukee or certainly a New York or Atlanta. So I'm curious about Mike. What can you give me, Mike, a couple of examples of real specific things that you have learned that you can now take care of in you know, if LGE has a problem there in Bailey's Harbor?
Yeah, really, I mean, the idiosyncrasies of the automation system are probably, learning them has really helped me sleep a little bit more at night, a little better in knowing, well, if the computer goes down, I know what I can do to restart. But as far as we've already been through the resending in of the emergency alert system box, we had a problem with a closure to where it wasn't, it was unlocking our STL. Hmm. So, I mean, things like that. But really, for our purposes and what we do, I think the automation system is the most integral part of what I deal with in what I felt comfortable in learning to help us do what we do. Like Chris had said, I mean, that was one of the things that we sat down and figured out what was going to be the most important piece that we really didn't want to have to deal with all the time. And some of the more, the bigger box items, the transmitter, the STL equipment, some of the things that, whether it's, you know, mod monitor or those kind of things. I mean, overall, it really, to me, it is about knowing the ins and outs of the automation system. for us.
That's interesting and very instructive what you say, because in describing both in the, this time when I asked you that question and when I asked it to you about 10 minutes ago, your answer didn't have much to do with the actual what we think is traditional broadcast equipment, like the audio console or a distribution amplifier or an audio processor or the STL. Now, you did mention the transmitter earlier, or at least Chris Tarr did, but you focused on IT matters, and that's kind of interesting. Doesn't that tell us something about where our jobs as radio engineers have gone?
I would think so.
Yeah, we still have to get to deal with some of this traditional technology. If you've got an analog or even a digital audio console, maybe that's not an IP-based audio console.
No, but Chris has built it, too, to where if something was to happen with the board, I just have to flip a switch and we bypass the board completely and still remain on the air.
Bam. Yeah, your automation goes directly to air, doesn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the way a lot of folks are building their facilities now. But isn't it interesting that automation is a huge part of what you do. Now, if that goes down, you do have a tough time staying on the air for very long, especially with perhaps nobody at the station. Somebody's got to spin CDs or play their iPod or something.
Right. Or it can be run from my laptop now, too. That's the thing, too. I mean, the studio goes down. Well, okay. You have your option of using LogMeIn or going through our SonicWall system and being able to take care of everything either from home or taking the laptop out to the transmitter. I mean, if you have your processor out there, that's fine. But if you don't, I mean, at least you have audio on the air. So, I mean, there is something that you can still do versus traditionally in the past to where if you were down at the studio, you were done.
Yeah.
It's just not like that anymore. I mean, the portability of how we can be more efficient as broadcasters. I mean, the technology has been amazing. And I think that's, you're right. And when you say that's today's engineer is really more about IT than it is about keeping the transmitter going. I mean, it's to the point where the things that I've seen just being in the business for 20 something plus years to there's no tube changing anymore and there's no this, that, and the other. And, the IP modules or the power modules can be switched out and you're not completely off the air. I mean, it's much more fail safe. And it makes me feel more comfortable as a first-time owner to go in that and not be completely overwhelmed with everything you need to know to keep yourself on the air.
Now, here's a couple of thoughts, and I agree with you completely that broadcast engineers nowadays have got to have some IT skills. They've got to know about IP addresses, and they've got to know something about networks, and this is not so difficult to learn if you don't know about these things. And I think there are not so many engineers left over now who don't know about how to do a lot of these things at either a basic level or a good strong level. One thing that is interesting is that you said that your transmitter's been reliable. Of course, they transmitter companies have been building transmitters for close to 100 years now. And certainly, Nautel's been around for 30 or 40 or 50 years. Companies like Harris, in one form or another, have been around for 60, 70 years or so. I'm not sure. So they've gotten really good at building reliable transmitters over all this time, whereas computers, PCs, software, all this is much, 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 much newer stuff. But something that's a little bit hidden, and that is the environment where your transmitter resides. And I'll bet you that Chris Tarr put his expertise into advising you or doing it himself, putting this transmitter into an environment where it was likely to survive. Yeah,
you have no idea what it looks like in the middle of this field in Door County, Wisconsin. we built in the surge protector box, and we really went above and beyond because we did know. I mean, that area of Door County it's very well known for power spikes and power failures and everything else. So I mean it. We had to make sure that our front end built in before the transmitter was really rock solid to protect it, without question.
What's my what do I keep telling you that you have to do every 3 months that you have to go out and do? Your only job at
the transmitter. I have to clean the filters all the time, make sure that that's clean.
Yes. These are air filters, yeah.
Yes, the air filters, yeah. So I'm that, and that's really, with those modern transmitters, I explained to him, really just keep them clean, Well, and there's another thing where they really went, Mike and Carrie really did a great job, is Carrie's father built the transmitter building.
Yeah.
And went to us and said, what do I need to do?
Oh, you know, to build this sweet building. Words to an engineer.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, so I told him how to, you know, where to put the blowers and the intakes, and, you know, they did a grounding system all the way around the building. And, you know, it really Jeff Welton from Nautel came up to see the transmitter, and he looked at this building and goes, I can't believe you guys built this. Like, you know, I've seen, you know, this is as good as some of the, you know, the big commercial buildings that we've, that we've bought. Yeah. And how much did you say it was? $1,000 is what it cost him to build it.
It's
10x10 building.
Without leaving out, I don't want to try to leave out any other broadcast transmitter manufacturer, but I got to tell you, one of the absolute best ways to learn about how to build or how to ground a transmitter building and keep it safe from lightning and surges is to look at the addendum usually in the back of the Nautel transmitter manuals. And right. I think this it's a document that I would feel sure is available online at the Nautel website.
It is.
It's a whole document about how to design a transmitter, how to not make the mistakes that so many people make. One of the classic ones is you build a transmitter building, and on one side of the building, the power comes in, and the other side of the building, the coax leaves the building and goes to the tower. Well, this is not the best design. It's better to have the power and the coax enter and egress the building on the same side of the building, so you can easily tie them together with short copper strap.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one way. So the transmitter is not a fuse sitting between the tower and the big electronic sink, which is the AC power system out there.
It's funny, things like that. You know, and I was thinking about that when you're talking about spending money with, you know, Buckley and things like that, and, you know, justifying decisions. I'll tell you, one of the most stressful things for me putting this thing together was, you know, here's a couple who put their life savings into this, you know, started in 1989 to get the allocation and then won it at auction and built this thing and kind of trusted me to put it all together and make it work. You know, I'm thinking, what if something goes horribly wrong here? You know, what if the transmitter burns down or the building, you know, it's hit by lightning and everything in the building smokes or, you know, there's a lot of pressure there. I think I put on myself for this, you know, and aside from being friends of mine, you know, knowing that, you know, they've put a lot of their life into this, and it's not like, and I don't want to, you know, knock working for a large company because I do and I enjoy it, but, you know, you don't feel so bad if you make a $500 mistake, you know, if you're at Intercom or a CBS or a Buckley. You really feel it if it's $500 mistake when it's, you know, your friend's radio station, you know, and that's all they do.
Yeah,
you know, so there's a lot of stress in putting that together and kind of hitting the power button and keeping your fingers crossed that you got everything right the first time. And, you know, so that was one of the fun things in doing all of this.
We've talked about good building construction and you mentioned about the proper airflow and keeping the filters clean, the transmitter clean. What do you think are a couple of good points that small town broadcasters can learn from big city broadcasters? I'm asking Chris Tarr, since Chris, you're involved in both. Yeah, what can we learn in small town radio?
You know, it's a good question, and one again that, you know, it's obvious from talking to Mike that I kind of taught him is, you know, two big things: preventive maintenance and you know, spending your money wisely and then in the right places. You know, because again, one of the things. You hear Mike talking about how, you know, it's mostly IT that he worries about. And, you know, the reason is because the way it was built. You know, had we used an old transmitter or used transmitter, had we not designed the building to run cleanly and you know, without worrying about power spikes and things, you'd have a lot more to worry about. And I think a lot of times it's kind of, you know, I completely get, you know, trying to be as frugal as possible. But there's a point where, you know, you cut so much out that it's either pay it now or pay it later. And a great little story about that is another client that I've got in a small town. It's got an AM. And I've been to their transfer site several times. And I said, listen, I need to, you know, we need to work out a deal here. We need to get this cleaned out. You know, it's dirty in here. This transmitter doesn't work. You know, it's barely on the edge. And, you know, I think you should set aside, you know, about 3 hours. I come down and help you and we'll get this cleaned out. Well, we can't afford to do that. Well, you know, I'll even cut you a deal because it needs to get done. Well, I'll get back to you. Well, you know, sure enough, about a month or two later, the temperature rose, and because the room was all dirty and sealed off and the filters were clogged, transmitter shut down. Well, guess what? They had to pay me an emergency fee to go down and fix it. So either way, they paid the money. So I think that's, you know, as if you're, you know, these small town broadcasters, you know, the most important thing you can do is ask your engineer, you know, what would you do if it was your money, and how would you do this? And, you know, and if you don't like the answers that you get, ask around, you know, until you get, you know, until you, you get a good consensus and you trust the guy that you're talking to. But I can't stress enough the preventative maintenance end of that, and to really, you know, automation systems, transmitters, things like that, you know, spend your money in the right places. You know, it's okay to cut corners with things like, you know, office furniture, but a transmitter is going to keep you on the air. That's, if you're off the air, you're not making any money. Spend your money.
One of my impressions of big city radio is that it seems like so often we feel like everything has to be done in a big city way, with either permits and approvals and union contracts, and everything's got to be done in such a big, organized and big city way. Tom and Chris Tobin, is there anything that big city engineers can learn from the got to get it done and do it as inexpensively as possible mentality that we have to live with in small town radio?
I could say, this is Chris in New York, I could say from working in smaller markets prior to my arrival in New York City, that one lesson I learned working with the two gentlemen that I was that mentored me, and they had at least 50 years, if not more, experience between them, keep it simple. The best approach is just keep it simple, you know, look at what you're doing and really say to yourself, who cares? Are you doing it right? If you are, then that's important. If you say to yourself, who cares, and you can't give a straight answer, then you know you've got a problem, whatever project you're working on. I can say personally myself at the current stations that I'm employed by, all of my systems and all my approaches to every solution is based on a simple, can it be repeated reliably, and can I deploy it without me being there? If I can make those three criteria work, then I know it can be applied anywhere I go. That's my approach to things, and that's what I think I've learned from the smaller, medium markets where you really have a chance to make those mistakes and sort of get away with it and learn from them and go, okay, that was the wrong approach. We'll fix it on the next turnaround. Whereas in the larger markets, some people aren't as tolerant, or they use that as an opportunity to advance their careers.
Tom, you've got stations in both big and small markets, don't you?
Oh, you bet. And I started in a smaller market in Hartford, Connecticut. And, you know, in the bigger cities, I mean, there's a lot of pressure to stay on the air. I mean, let's face it, no matter what market you're in, if you're off the air, there's going to be a problem. You have no income coming into the station at that point. But it tends to kind of hit home in the bigger markets because they want to stay on the air. And in the bigger markets, we tend to be lucky enough to have the equipment, have the personnel, have what we need to keep the facility up and running. What I found in the smaller markets and the way I learned coming up was that you had to be creative. A lot of times you had to be creative. You know, the ultimate goal was keeping it on the air. You had to really keep the budget in mind. And you learn an awful lot about being creative and what you can do. And this isn't meant to be derogatory by any stretch of the imagination, but you learn what you can do with chewing gum and paper clips. You know, because literally I've been at stations where that's all we've had to work with, and you somehow make it work.
I've used that approach on many outside broadcasts and many remotes. Believe it
or not. God, yeah.
That the concept of chewing gum and rubber bands and tape apply anywhere you go, and you do learn from those. I will say you're right, Tom. It's not to be derogatory at all. It's actually a very, very good learning experience.
Let's continue in this practical vein and talk about some real specifics. Chris Tobin suggested that we include in this episode some talk about transmitter site stormy weather preparedness, and especially wintry stormy weather. And Chris supplied us with a nice list of some things that we need to pay attention to at transmitter sites, and maybe some of these apply to studios as well. Chris, do you want to run over a couple of these ideas for us and tell us how you're taking care of stormy weather preparedness?
Sure. Actually, I've applied this principle at many facilities over the last 20 years, and the simple stuff has been emergency phone numbers on an 8 by 8.5 by 11 piece of paper, laminated if you choose, but some kind of protective plastic cover, at the door, on the inside of the door when you come in. Numbers of personnel, either the radio station, local police, fire, emergency services, depending on the town and what you have. flashlights at the entry point. The last thing you want to do is walk into your building in the pitch darkness and say, oh, the flashlight in the car doesn't work, but I have one at the transmitter building somewhere.
Ah, yeah.
What I typically would do is use fluorescent, glow-in-the-dark strips. There's a name for them. You put that on one side of the flashlight, so when the lights do go out eventually, hopefully it has enough fluorescence to stay.
Oh, yeah, those, okay.
The other thing that I've done is if you have a site that has ice shields for mm-hmm. your cable trays, check to make sure that they're not full of debris, because when the ice forms on those or hits them, the extra weight sometimes exceeds the capacity, and your tray now gets collapsed.
By the way, back to the flashlight, I've got to tell you, I got a wonderful opportunity a few years ago to visit the transmitter site of WLS just outside Chicago, on the south side of Chicago, and the engineer there is Warren Schultz. Warren gave me the tour of the transmitter site, and it was a delightful place. Absolutely, so much redundancy going on there at WLS. And you talk about flashlights. Warren must have owned stock in a flashlight company. There had to have been close to 20 flashlights in the transmitter building itself. And yeah, they were just, I mean, you could be anywhere in the building, the power goes off, and not an arm's length away, there would be a flashlight magnetically attached to a transmitter or in a some kind of a holder on the wall next to the entrance door, the different doors in, you know, next to desks, anywhere you needed a flashlight, there was a flashlight.
I bet you they were lit when that blowtorch was turned on too, wasn't it?
No, they stayed off, but you know what, as Chris Tobin suggested, they did have the glow in the dark strips on the side of them, so you could see them with the lights out.
Yeah, no, I've also done that strip striping on the floor around the transmitters as well. So when you're in,
so you don't bump your head into one.
Exactly, on overhead plumbing, it's very handy. The other thing that I've done, and we've just started redoing the stuff at the transmitter sites recently, installing webcams at the transmitter site that you can access either over your STL link or DSL, whatever you might have.
Yeah,
and it's very handy when you have bad weather and you're getting calls, or your remote control is calling you and there's issues at the transmitter site. A couple of, you know, these webcams now have such great resolution and they're point tilt zoom. You can go crazy.
Oh, I do that. I've got a transmitter site, one of my Class Bs, that's literally 40 miles away on a bluff in the middle of nowhere, it's great because I can. You know, it's still panable, but it's usually focused right on the transmitter, so I can see what status lights are lit. Makes troubleshooting a whole lot easier from 40 miles away.
Yeah. Well, we I'll tell you a funny story. A transmitter site that I had the webcams installed at, we had issues with the front gate. We found the front gate open on many occasions, and it was a motorized gate, all the special sensors to make it easy when you're coming up in the van, and the weather is horrible, and you just don't want to be getting out into it. We get the alarm that the gate's open. We know there's nobody out there because we didn't defeat it. So we reviewed the videotape, or the video that's recorded by the webcam system. Very handy. We discovered a squirrel was jumping through a sensor that was apparently wired incorrectly. The sensor is designed to stop the gate in case a vehicle happens to be in too close. It was apparently wired that when you broke the sensor beam, it opened the gate.
Oh, jeez.
But it was the funniest thing. We justified the purchase of this elaborate video camera tilt system, you know, like access from everything. And we sat there and go, wow, you felt like you're watching one of those movies. We had $4 million worth of arsenal or ammunition and technology to beat those guys, and it came down to a squirrel tail. That's what it was.
Chris, do you remember what brand or what model of webcam that you like to use out there?
The one that I used a lot that was really popular was the, I have one here actually, the SecuraCam from D-Link. It's a self-contained web server as well as a LAN connection. You can do a lot with it. It's got Wi-Fi built in. The DCS-6620G. They may have a version by now.
DCS, what was that?
DCS-6620G as in George.
Okay.
Handy. It works really well. Pan, tilt, zoom. It's great.
I'll research that and put that or its successor in the show notes.
Something else to consider for those with transmitter sites, whether it be in a building or out in the field, try and find a way to hook up with your local police, fire, or public works department directors, and take them on a tour of the facility, show them what's about, explain to them what's going on. I say this only because 15, 18 years ago in a place I worked at, our tower, which was a 500-foot tower sitting in the middle of downtown city, everybody drove past it. It was right smack in the middle of residential areas as well as commercial. And, you know, invariably something would happen, and I get a phone call from somebody complaining that their kid's got three eyes and he doesn't. I took the folks from Public Works, fire, police, out to the site on a regular basis every quarter, walked them through, showed them what was going on. And I'll tell you, when those phone calls came into City Hall or police headquarters, those guys were the first, were like, you know, they took care of 90% of the calls that were crackpots. I'd get a call from the police chief or his subordinate and say, hey, just letting you know, we got a couple of calls from people complaining. We had a patrol car in the area. They stopped by. They saw nothing. They told us what was happening. We took care of it. Just letting you know that, you know, somebody called. I'm like, wow, okay. Prior to that, I used to get the calls every week, every month. It was crazy. So food for thought. Because you got to remember, when people see something they don't know, who they first call? They're not calling you. They're going to call the police.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know this, and what prompted me to do this with the local folks was one night during a winter storm, our tower, which was an AM-FM tower, it was a shunt-fed tower, and then we went to a skirt. The storm rolled through. The conditions were just ripe. Snow coming down, very feathery, very light, and it was hitting the guy wires, the tower, and we had sort of like the St. Elmo's effect on a mass of a ship.
Oh.
I got a phone call, 2 o'clock in the morning, fire department calls me. We're getting reports. Your tower is on fire. We know that it's hard to believe, but we have to go investigate. We need you to come down. I'm like, yeah, that's a good one. I'm on my way. Yeah, you know, of course it's a blizzard conditions. I've got to drive out. And sure enough, as luck would have it, I'm looking up and you see sparks coming off the guy wires, and you can see him from about 3 blocks away.
Oh my goodness!
On his 500-foot tower. I'm going, this is great. But again, the relationship I had with the local police, fire, and public safety. Handle like a charm. I mean, they were great. So just food for thought. That's something that's totally non-technical, has nothing to do with the radio station facility or anything, but those are the people that come knocking at your door when there's a problem.
Yeah, yeah. So. And have them aware of who you are and what you do and kind of what goes on there. Boy, that sure can have that comfort level with them where they don't look at it as this black box, this area that they don't know anything about.
And you know, it kind of helps to give them a little pat on the back once in a while, too, whether you give them a shout-out on the air or just to thank them for being there during lousy weather or whatever. I mean, our transmitter site is, we're in the middle of nowhere. And, I mean, believe it or not, 6 miles from New York City, we're in the middle of nowhere. And when we were building the site, there were a lot of people, because the area was being developed, that had ridden dirt bikes and ATVs back there. And they were upset because, you know, their ATV riding place was being all torn up for development. And they were repeatedly cutting the chains off my tower fences. So I was out there one Saturday, and there were a bunch of them out there, and I pulled my car in the middle of the road right in front of them and stopped them and said, guys, look, I'm not your enemy. I didn't want to move it here. We were forced to move. I said, you know, look, we have a nice parking lot here. You want to go have a little picnic? Go ahead. Just all I ask is you clean up. I said, just don't cut my locks. Please don't cut my locks. I mean, you know, you want to have a couple of guys out here. You want to have a couple of brews. It's okay. Just don't destroy the place. And ever since I did that, I gave them all my business card. Ever since I've done that, if they find anything out of place out there, I get a phone call.
Huh.
I have not had any vandalism, and they just, if they see anything out of place, my phone rings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I always make it a habit, like our local fire department, police department. You know, we'll give them station T-shirts and stuff like that when they come by. And, yeah, same thing. Anything looks out of place, you know, instead of them acting and reacting, you know, you should just get a call. You know, even, for example, I had a tower light out. You know, that guy called me, said, I don't know if you knew this, but you got a tower light out. You know,
that's cool.
No problem. You know, yeah.
It works. It really does. Trust me.
Oh, you bet.
I've done it many places.
Chris, you had a couple more things on your list. Portable gas genset at the site. Now, so you're talking about a site that may not have backup power there?
No. I'm talking about a site. This happened to me years and years ago. That's why I say this.
Yeah.
We had a generator. You know, we thought it worked fine. We ran it every week. We did a load test once a month. We thought everything was in order. Storm rolled through. and something went wrong with the transfer switch because of the utility side of the switch getting a hit of lightning or, you know, something nearby. It fried something in the switch. I'm not sure what it was.
Oh, so it couldn't switch over.
So, come on. So we had nothing out there. Thank goodness I had one of the promotional vehicles at the time. So in the back of that, we had a little portable genset. Pull that little guy out, powered it up, got some drop lights going. Also powered up my cell phone at the time. And we've got everything going. We're like, aha. Uh-huh. Ever since then, I keep one handy. I'm telling you.
Good idea.
It's worth it. And boy, it's happened again a couple other times. The other thing, other suggestion I have for folks is, this is something, again, it's obvious, but you never do it. When the weather reports on radio or television are reporting, you know, stormy weather on the horizon, something's coming your way, contact the folks that support your facility and schedule a preventive maintenance, if you can, prior to the storm arrival. I can't tell you how many times I've done that, and we've found stuff. We actually found something wrong that would have been picked up on the next PM. But if it happened during the storm, which means you would be running a generator for several hours straight under load, probably wouldn't make it.
Yeah.
Well worth it. And the same is true for snow removal or landscaping companies, in case it's a hurricane or anything like that that takes down trees that you need removed. If you have contracts with them, call them up and say, hey, look, this report of X, can you come out here and do a little extra, you know, trimming on the side? Or if there is snow, can you put us at the top of the list when it hits? We're ready to get you out there and make things happen. I've done that too. Pays in spades.
Chris, a common theme that I hear you talking about, all of these ideas result in less dependence on a single engineer to remember phone numbers, know where the flashlight is,
yes,
know who the police people are. Less dependence on one person and more autonomy for the site, or more of an ability for anybody to go handle a problem and not just the engineer who knows everything about that, not just the point man.
That's right. It's born out of my public safety training I've taken over the years. Working at various facilities for emergency management purposes. So I've taken that thinking and applied it to broadcast. It's paid off very well.
So
and think about it. I mean, if you're the only guy who knows anything about the site, or the only guy who goes out there or whatever, what happens if something happens to you? And
right.
they need to get in there right now. I mean, like the WR facility, when you go in, I've got hidden keys out there. Master control room has a book. It states where the key is. Everything in the building is labeled.
In my situation, you have to, because I'm
right,
it.
Right.
I don't have a staff. So if something, you know, if I'm in Door County right now and something goes wrong in Milwaukee, I got a backup guy. He's about an hour away. You know, they need to be, you know, somewhat self-sufficient to at least cover the easy stuff.
Yep.
You know, and that's, you know, and because 99% of the time, it's, you know, it's something like that where you probably don't need me to jump to, you know, get yourself back on track. But way too many times you've got, you know, the one guy who holds all the secrets to the building, you know, something as simple as, you know, that a certain breaker trips, you know, in a certain condition, you know, let everybody know that.
I've been burned by that, taking over from the facility, and they, you know, they tell me, well, the guy that was here before you did everything. I said, I see that. Did he keep any notes? We don't know. And you go out to the transmitter site, nothing. And you're like, wow, okay. Yeah, that's what I learned the hard way.
Yeah, I think engineers do themselves a disservice by not documenting and by not spreading the word and by not sharing their knowledge, even specific knowledge of a site or a place or a studio or a wiring scheme or a technical operations center with other engineers. You know, documenting it or telling other people about it. There are some people who certainly have the mentality of, well, I need to stay valuable, so I need to keep this information to myself so that they need me. But in the long run, that's not a good plan.
The reality is, it's not job security. It's a load of bunk.
Yeah,
it never has been, never will be. And, you know, your skill sets will definitely.
Yeah, I stepped in and figured it all out. You know, after they got, you know, replaced me. You know, replaced the guy who was there before me. I didn't have any notes. I figured it out after a while. So
yeah, same here.
It can be done. You know, I think, you know, some of that too, especially with in the smaller markets, you know, there are some contract engineers who like to do that, you know, kind of helps them make work for themselves. I think it a little bit too, which is why, you know, I advise these guys like Mike and some of the other guys, ask me all the questions, ask me how everything works. I'll be more than happy to show you, because, you know, the fewer times you have to call me, the better it is for you and for me.
And I actually have a story about contract engineer and how he kept the business for himself.
Yeah.
I took over for a station, and I got a phone call. They said, I just took over, maybe 2 weeks, just contract work. They call me up. We're off frequency. I'm like, really? Well, when there's a position on the remote control, we're supposed to take a frequency check every hour, every shift. Okay. The license frequency of the radio station was at 99.9, and apparently the readings were showing 100.5 or something. I was like, well, you can't be off frequency. I'm listening to you right now. I'm 10 miles away. No, we're off frequency. I got to shut down the transmitter. I said, don't shut down the transmitter. Do nothing. You're fine. He read me the other readings. I logged in remotely. I checked. I was like, I'm on my way in to the transmit site. I'll find out what's going on. Don't panic. Of course, the guy panics, calls the PD. Everything goes crazy. So I get out to the transmit site. I'm looking around this rat's nest. Yeah, 2 weeks. I haven't even had a chance to really, get your head around stuff.
Yeah.
I'm looking. I'm like, all right, let me see. He's got this thing wired, this position here, and the remote control. I follow this little Belden 8451 down into the rack itself and down the base of cables. I'm like, wow, this is interesting. I start tugging. I hear a little box fall. Wow. Keep pulling. And I pull up this box. I have to about 50 feet of cable, of course. It's a battery.
Oh, no.
That's right. With the frequency of the shift, it was time to change batteries.
Oh, and every once in a while, I hear, and I'm sure you do too, hear these stories about an engineer who put a battery on the remote control sampling.
Yes.
To give a nice stable reading over time.
Yes. Oh, I'll never forget that one. That was the best. Wow. Oh, that's a good one.
And what does it read when you turn the transmitter off?
It continues reading.
99.9.
Boy, our modulation's real hot tonight. Battery across the mod meter.
We got to say...
How they knew
my
that.
Frequency is 9 volts.
We'll have another War Stories episode come episode number 20 of This Week in Radio Tech, and that'll be a good time to share some more of these that I'm sure we'll think of. Remind me to tell you about the guy who called and told me the tower lights were on.
Uh-oh.
Or no, I'm sorry. He told me the tower lights were off, but it was during the day. Yeah, and he had already called the airport and the FAA and yeah.
Well, hey, my tower lights, I have strobes during the day, so I technically could have somebody call me and say that.
Sure you could. Yeah, yeah. Hey, we've come to the end of the show, and I want to thank Mike Messick of WLGE for being with us, along with Chris Tarr. Mike, thank you very much.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, we sure appreciate you telling us about small-town radio engineering, what you've learned, and I hope to check back with you again sometime. Hey, can we hear your station online or see your website?
Yeah, you bet. FM1069thelodge.com.
Whoa, I got to write that down. Let's see. FM1069.
Yep, 1069.
Lodge. Lodge.
LODGE.com.
You mean nobody else had that name? You got it?
Nope.
Cool.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
Yeah, we explored that too. Nobody out west. That was it was kind of interesting. But we had looked at the bay or the lake or something like that up here, and we had tossed around, the cabin, the something. We thought, hey, lodge. That's not it. And it has really worked because it is very unique.
It is. It is. And
it is.
It sounds like a good, comfortable name. So again, Mike, thanks for joining us. We'll put that. We'll put the link to your radio station in the show notes. Chris Tarr, thanks for being with us as well.
No problem. Good to be here.
And we're going to wrap it up quickly. Chris Tarr, you got a website to mention, I believe?
Yeah. Just stop by geekjedi.com, GEEKJEDI.com.
Geekjedi.com. Chris Tobin, thanks for spending another Wednesday evening with us. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
All right. And Tom Ray, appreciate you being there, too. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate you having me, and we'll be definitely seeing you next year.
And all of our listeners, thanks for joining us. We're getting several hundred downloads a week now, so appreciate you listening to the show. Tell your friends. Send in your requests, your requests and dedications. We have a forum on the website. We have places to comment on each individual show, and we'll try to get to those. And every few episodes, we do get to a number of listener requests. And look for us on video within the next, hope the next month, 6 weeks at the most or so, sometime in February. I think we'll be able to do that. Thanks for joining us for another This Week in Radio Tech.
That's all the bandwidth we can pilfer this week. Another tort has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
This week in Radio Tech.
Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show.
Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes Store.
Soliciting is strictly encouraged.
If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here.
Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny LePay Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.